Emerald Podcast Series. Research that makes a difference.
Welcome to the Emerald Podcast Series. I'm your host, Tom Shields, Communications Manager at Emerald Publishing. Today, I'm speaking with David Roach about his book, The Innovation Approach. David teaches graduate courses in entrepreneurship and innovation at the Rose School of Business at Dalhousie University in Canada. The Innovation Approach, Overcoming the Limitations of Design Thinking and the Lean Startup, explores the challenges faced by modern innovation methodologies. In the book, David looks at core principles, discussing the strengths of design thinking and lean startup, and highlighting how a robust concept combined with a realistic business model can lead to success. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I begin the podcast by asking David to tell us a little bit about his background.
Oh my goodness, I have quite a varied background. My first career was as an automotive engineer with General Motors. And when I was 26 years old, I was asked to join a multifunctional engine development team. It was the first time it was done in GM's history, so I really got to understand, you know, as an engineer, how all the other pieces fit together, you know, from design to the marketing folks, et cetera. And one thing that I noticed, you know, you can imagine you're in these boardrooms, 30-foot ceilings, and these tables that hold 100 people. It was quite impressive in hindsight. But I noticed all these consultants hanging around these projects, and all they seemed to do was translate between the technical factions of the organization and the business factions. And, you know, once I was through the project, it was, you know, it was quite successful for the corporation. I said, I think that's what I want to do. And I spent the rest of my career really, you know, effectively becoming an expert in the whole area of innovation management. And I also teach entrepreneurship, and I'm an entrepreneur myself. So I also understand how the two, entrepreneurship and innovation, work as a system.
Yeah. And that sort of leads us nicely into the first question, David. The book states that, you know, the book itself has been in various different forms throughout a long period of almost four decades. Would you be able to talk us through that development process and what that's looked like and what your writing process has been, and maybe map that journey from four decades ago up until the book getting published?
You know, I've always been a very insanely curious person, and I've been called innovative, and I'm not sure innovation and creativity are the thing. I think it's curiosity, frankly. But, you know, after I was through with General Motors and this multifunctional engine development process and really got fascinated by what was happening, I decided I needed more background, certainly on the business side as an engineer. So I went back and did an MBA at Dalhousie University, where I now teach, and met my wife and decided to stay here. So then, you know, I was wondering, well, you know, a person with my background, what could I do here? So I eventually joined the Nova Scotia Research Foundation, which became what was known as the Nova Corps, which got involved with, you know, some, you know, small seed capital venture financing. We had a small $35 million fund. So I really got to understand a lot of the strategic planning around innovation management with small, medium-sized enterprises. I got to work on how we finance and structure early stage investments. And after a few years of that, I said, you know, I don't really think my job is to be an armchair quarterback, frankly. And so I went out and I did executive hire positions in multiple industries. I've worked in giftware. I've worked in toys. I've worked in aerospace. I've worked in biotechnology. I've worked in medical devices. And so really, you know, tried to take a holistic look at all these various industries. And there really is a set of common problems that need to be addressed, you know, both on the business and innovation side. And parallel to that, in 1996, I was approached by my university where I was a graduate. And they said to me, we have this crazy concept that we're seeing coming out of places like Carnegie Mellon, Delft University, and at the time, I think Stanford and RISD, Rhode Island School of Industrial Design. And it's this multifunctional education. And my wife's an artist, and I'm an engineer, also a business person. And they said, would you be interested in helping us craft this program? So we actually put together a program where we had artists from our art college here. We had engineering students, and we had MBA marketing students work in these multifunctional groups over two semesters to come up with these new products and services. And it was groundbreaking at the time. You know, there really were four, possibly five institutions in the world doing that at the time. And, you know, this later became what is now espoused as design thinking. I mean, we were doing it back in the days where we didn't really know what to call this except multifunctional development. And then, so as part of that, I was teaching at the university. I was actually teaching an MBA course in technology marketing. And so in parallel, I always like to learn from the best of the best. So in parallel, every time I would take another executive position, I would always make sure they paid for some education for me. So I ended up taking an executive course at Harvard, MIT, Babson, Kellogg, University of Chicago. And every time I would get curious on a particular aspect of innovation management or entrepreneurship, I would go take a 2 or 5 day executive course. And of course, learning from the best of the best, I would try then to say, how can I bring this back and apply it to the area I work in, which is really small, medium-sized enterprises, and, you know, by default, early stage or startup organizations. So when I put that all together, it was my way of doing it. And eventually, I became so fascinated that I said, I really need to do a PhD to really get to the core of a lot of this stuff. And I ended up doing a PhD in product management, which is a hybrid between marketing and engineering. I don't know if that's a long dissertation, but that's really how I came to be where I am. And now I'm a full-time faculty member as well as, you know, a business owner.
So you're never bored, as we said earlier before we started recording. So David, in the book, I kind of want to get into some of the topics within the book, but first of all, you say in the introduction that you hope that it'll be somewhat controversial, but embraced by most. And who do you think the book is for, and who's the ideal audience in your mind for the book?
Yeah, that's interesting. I just got off FaceTime with my daughter in the UK, and we were just talking about that. And she said, you know, Dad, this reads like a textbook. I said, yes, it is a textbook, but it's I think it's more than that. I think it's a guide for executives. And I think that's why I think it'll be controversial, and I'm not sure how it will be adopted. I know my academic peers will find all kinds of academic loopholes or things that they believe I haven't defended academically. I think, you know, proponents of design thinking and lean startup are likely going to come and say, well, that's not actually how it works, but this book is about not how either one of those systems works. It's how they were actually implemented in practice. That is what was really bugging me. And it's funny, you know, like I use it as a textbook for one of my classes in MBA classes in innovation management. And, you know, I always reread my chapters before we have our sessions. And I realize now how many of the sentences and paragraphs are structured, that there's quite a bit of depth there. And I think, you know, if you're an executive and you're really interested in how do I structure my innovation management practices to best create winners for outcomes, I think that, you know, as you reread, what I like when you reread a book, you find little nuances that you missed the first time that sometimes become that little spark that, you know, changes something you're doing for the better.
As you just pointed out, there's a lot of depth to the book, and it does go into a lot of detail. And as we said before we pressed record on this podcast, you know, it's going to be impossible to dive into all aspects of it. But what I think would be really nice for the audience to hear would be, and I know this is a broad question, but the book talks about how innovation must be understood before it can be managed. So what is innovation?
Well, that's interesting. And I think I talk about it in the second or third chapter. And this is something I've done. So I've taught executive courses. I've taught MBA courses, undergraduate courses. I've taught in Europe, United States, various times. And when I started an innovation class, specifically with executive or graduate students, I asked them, what is innovation? because I find it fascinating. Because when you ask people what innovation is, you get all kinds of different answers. You get novelty, you get creativity, you get all kinds of different constructs that come at you. So then I kind of switch the focus and I say, well, give me an example of great innovation. And people come up with the usual things, you know, Tesla, Post-it notes, you know, it depends, those types of things. And then I switched the thing. I said, well, tell me about innovations that failed. They find that a little bit harder. But oftentimes they will find them, you know, anything from the new taste of Coke to, you know, I can't even remember all the other ones. And so what we do is we effectively frame, here's the construct of innovation if we take just what's in this class. And then I say, well, let's dig into this a little bit further and find out what are some of the core pieces that really are about innovation. And so a few things start to jump out very quickly. You know, one is success. Nothing's been called an innovation if it was unsuccessful. Okay. So success has to be part of that definition. Okay. Well, how do you judge success? Well, success means that really, and there's various ways to look at this, but I always talk about adoption. It must be adopted either commercially or socially. It must be adopted for it to be seen as successful. Okay. You know, there's other things like the solution. There has to be a solution that's different than that is available. It starts to, you know, create the space between what is the, how do we create solutions? It's depending on how the problem is defined. You know, it always gets into who. Innovation, you know, to you may be different for me. You know, I was playing around with my wireless mic, which is not quite working the way I would like it to. You know, I have a different relationship with that than you may have with what you're using on your end. So when you put it all together, what the most concise definition I can come to is effectively the following. Unique solutions that are successfully adopted by the relevant, what we now call the decision-making unit, we used to call it stakeholders. I think that definition brings all of those constructs together. So it must be adoptable. There must be some unique something unique about it. It really has to be targeted at the audience that really needs to know. And by default, you need to understand their problem space, and it must match your solution space.
You talked earlier about working with artists from the Art College. And in the book, you talk about the difference between creativity and innovation. So can you talk a bit about the difference between creativity and innovation and what, you know, what you think that might be?
Yeah. So, you know, I attend a lot of conferences, you know, where I present academic papers and I even chair some sessions in different places. And in a lot of these entrepreneurship specifically, and to some extent, the innovation conferences, there's always a stream on creativity. And, you know, how do we teach creativity? How do we make people more creative? How can you incent your management team to actually come up with more unique solutions? So I understand that. But what I see in practice, and I guess I'll really go back to the fundamental premise of this book, is that in practice, I see it very poorly implemented. Let's take, you know, some classic examples. I have an innovation problem. I'm a company. Things aren't going well. I hire a consultant. So maybe I hire a design thinking consultant. You know, oftentimes those types of consultants come out of the creativity genre, if you want to call it that. So they tend to be creativity centric, not innovation management centric. So what happens is that there's a propensity to jump very quickly to the creative process without having it targeted. So what happens is that you end up with very broad brush, likely a lot of very creative concepts and ideas, but you've actually created a bigger problem for yourself and sorting through which ones actually might actually align with what you're trying to do from an innovation management perspective. So I'm a big fan of creativity. I work with a lot of creative people. You know, for instance, one of my great colleagues, an industrial designer at the Art College, very creative guy, but extremely focused. I could give him pretty much any problem, and I know that the space he would get creative within would be very targeted. But these folks are rare. So, you know, so I see, you know, in some cases, like design thinking has drifted too far in practice. It's not exactly how it's designed, but in practice, to the rush to creativity. Where the lean startup, on the other hand, really believes that creativity is mostly focused on creativity of the business model, in my opinion.
Yeah, you did mention, you know, that idea of design thinking, and the book's subtitle is Overcoming Limitations to Design Thinking and the Lean Startup. Just for the benefit of the audience, would you mind just spend some time talking through the principle of design thinking and what that's all about?
Yeah, well, design thinking is really became extremely popular, let's say, in the late 90s, mostly based on the consulting firm IDEO that came out of Stanford, and it's, you know, the Stanford D School. The reason it became so popular is NBC Nightline had a 1998 expose on IDEO and their design process, where they challenged the IDEO team to actually come up with a new concept for a shopping cart. It's available all over the internet. It's about a 20-minute video, and it walks through their process. So I often use it in my class as a way to talk about design thinking, and, you know, have my students critically look at what the video actually is showing them. So when you look at, you know, through naked eyes, or let's say a nascent type of eye, what you see is you see happy people bucking the status quo, shooting Nerf balls, you know, doing all kinds of making little rough and ready prototypes, etc. What you don't really see, and there's a reason IDEO is still the best firm in the world, is because there's much more depth to what they're doing. So what you see on the surface is actually not necessarily the process behind it. Fundamentally, design thinking is about getting to the problems, you know, empathizing with the customer, the end user, to try to understand their needs. Okay. It relies on both what we call probe and learn type of information gathering and observation. So fundamentally, it makes a lot of sense. If you strip down their process, it's much more than that. They have a lot of focus at the front end on secondary research, where they really try to get to the core of what they would probe and learn on. And this is one of my, you know, I guess, if you want to call it critiques or limitations of design thinking. In practice, I find that that's been short-circuited, and they tend to jump directly into what we call primary research without doing the background research that kind of guides it. Like, for instance, in the IDEO shopping cart video, all the secondary research gets them to the conclusion that there's certain things that they need to really understand better. One was theft of shopping carts. One was safety. One was the checkout experience. And there was a few others. So when they go and they do their primary research, they're already have narrowed their solution space to try to understand this in depth. And then what they've added to that is they've added a lot of the creativity, or what they call ideation types of activities. A lot of this, what is now being called the minimal viable product testing, we used to call that, you know, vicarious prototyping, and feedback loops so that you actually pull it all together. So again, if you're an IDEO or you're hiring IDEO, there's no question in my mind they will do a fabulous job. But in practice, what I've observed over the last 20 years is, mostly management consultants that really don't really understand the depth of what needs to be done. And some of it's driven also by their clients. You know, clients really want to see cool stuff in ideation. Sometimes, you know, consultants are driven to do what the client really wants, even though they know it may not be the best outcome that they need. I think I talked about in the article, there was an article, MIT Sloan, about 15 years ago, where they did a survey of organizations asking where they spent their money at the front end of innovation. And one of the places, or I think it was first or second place, was on creativity sessions. And then they asked them in a subsequent survey, is where do they need the most help in their innovation process? The last thing on their list was coming up with more ideas. So the question is why? So creating more ideas, if it's not within a systematic process, can actually create a larger problem in your innovation system, because now you have to sort through all these ideas, which is very difficult. It's prone to political issues. And in a lot of cases, alienates the team that it may have come up with some really good ideas because they feel they're not being listened to because of the volume of ideas that need to be sifted through. And so, you know, some end up on the cutting floor when perhaps they shouldn't.
Just to sort of change gears slightly, the book touches on the subject of uncertainty. And given the way things are currently across the world in early 2025, is there anything you would add to the book in hindsight if you were to write it again?
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting question, actually. When you look at uncertainty, you have to look at, there's different types of uncertainty. So the uncertainty I think you're talking about is what we call environmental turbulence in the academic literature. So the things that are happening outside of, let's say, the firm or the industry are impacting and creating uncertainty that then gets reflected. The uncertainty I'm really looking at is both of these systems, both design thinking and a lean startup, are effectively designed to drive out uncertainty within the innovation process. So there's always technical uncertainty. There's certainly, we call market uncertainty, but really it's end user or user decision-making unit uncertainty. And then there's the economic or the viability uncertainty. So I don't know that I would change anything, because I went to great pains to avoid the whole academic area of environmental uncertainty or environmental turbulence, because that really is just a driver of what you may want to focus on as you focus on a project. You know, in Canada right now, we've just got hit with 25% tariffs on our aluminum and steel. That's an environmental turbulence problem. If you bring it down to the innovation management piece, then which projects now will be highlighted within organizations that are trying to overcome some of these issues that have been created because of the environmental turbulence?
Yeah. And in a similar vein, you know, the book talks about sustainability and the advantages and sort of disadvantages of working around sustainable practices. How do you see that developing in the coming years? And do you think we're going to be in that place where things, projects may be held back slightly? Or how do you feel?
Again, that's an environmental turbulence problem. I think, you know, the reality is, if you know, I work with young people every day. They really are not going to put up with not trying to do things more sustainably. So I think culturally, I think it's embedded now. So I think that's a good thing. Now, how it's driven by outside forces is a different thing. You know, when I look at it, the other thing I try to get to in the book is that the last part of my innovation approach is actually sustainability. And I know that will really upset some people, because they really believe that you must drive innovation at the genesis of the product or service you're creating in order to be successful at the end. And I really admire that thinking. I've actually, one of my companies I have right now, I have a very strong environmental product, but it doesn't come from that as the driving force. And I'll tell you why. What happens is, when you're developing a product or service, the objective is that you want to be, again, going back to my definition, successful. Successful means adopted. Okay. So if I start a project, say I'm going to create 100% sustainable product that nobody buys, then what impact have I had? I've had virtually nothing, or a very small sliver of people. If I start a project, we're going to create value in a product category that's better than the customer's next best option, their benchmark, then I have a really good starting point. So I think the end point is, now how can we make that the most sustainable product that we can right now? And maybe we get a 40, 50, 60% sustainable while maintaining the value proposition. And now you have an impact. And I'll go back to, you know, Stephen Eppinger was interviewed in the MIT Sloan article many years ago. And he came, I guess, to the same conclusion that I've always had, is that you're better off impacting a category to get it as sustainable as can be accepted at the time. But what you do is you reset the baseline for the next innovation iteration, which may get you another 20% more sustainable. And if we all thought this way, then, you know, we could actually impact change.
So I've saved the toughest question for last, David.
I'm shocked.
I think this one, I like to ask this of everyone that joins me on the podcast here, because I think it stumps a lot of people, but we get some good answers in the end. And that is, so what one key takeaway would you like a reader to take from your book, and why is it important?
One takeaway. If I think about the overarching, the one takeaway is innovation is a system, okay? And it's not just being creative. I think that's the driving force. You know, I and again, I'll probably be held to task for this from the creativity folks, but if you approach innovation management purely from a creativity perspective, your probability of being successfully adopted by the relevant decision-making unit is low. You know, creativity sessions, you know, I've been in many. I've actually, you know, managed several. I've been on the outside looking in on a lot. You know, they're very exciting. I talk about it in the book. It creates this esprit de corps, you know. People really feel like they belong, like they're actually making a difference, et cetera. You know, management sees it. It looks like things are happening. But without that being part of an overall innovation management system, usually the outcomes are poor. And it actually causes more trouble than what you're trying to solve in the first place, specifically with the people involved, because they feel, you know, we did all this great work, nothing came out of it. You know, management is not listening to us, is what often comes out of that. So I think that probably would be the big jump. If I kind of lean over to the lean startup side, the big takeaway on the lean startup side is, you know, they push for customer listening. I don't know how many times I've heard push for 100 interviews. Sending engineers and scientists and computer scientists without training on how to do probe and learn information gathering. I don't care if you do 100 or if you do 1,000. Your chance of getting beyond incremental innovations is not great.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. For more information on today's guest and for a transcript of the show, please visit our website. I'd like to thank David Roach and the studio, This Is Distorted.